What could be one of the most consequential Supreme Court cases this term, affecting tens of thousands of people in Texas? We'll have a preview today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, the nation's highest court set to hear arguments over DACA, the program that protects some 700,000 people from deportation. President Trump's tried to unravel it. We'll look more closely at what's at stake. Also, is Mexico taking a page from President Trump's policy toward migrant families? Separation south of the border. And what does it mean to get good at responding to mass shootings? All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Monday, the 11th day of November, 2019. I'm David Brown. Thanks so much for spending a bit of your Texas time with us. If it seems like the 2020 election cycle has been going on for quite a long time now, there may be a reason for that. Before he was president, candidate Donald Trump made a certain issue the centerpiece of his campaign. You may know the one we're talking about here. Immigration. He promised to undo a policy put in place by his predecessor that offered deportation protection for some 700,000 undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children and who continued to live here illegally. This is the so-called DACA program. DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. In the fall of 2017, President Trump announced plans to rescind DACA, claiming that the Obama administration did not follow the proper procedures in instituting the program in the first place. Legal challenges popped up almost immediately, and three of those cases have been consolidated for oral arguments tomorrow at the Supreme Court. It is worth noting that what the court has agreed to consider is not whether DACA is legal, but instead whether the Trump administration's efforts at dismantling DACA are legal. And with election season coming up and President Trump's Democratic challengers all nipping at his heels, promising to undo the current administration's policies, there aren't many cases this term with a potential for so much impact. Jeffrey Hoffman is the director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Houston. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's my understanding that the justices have actually consolidated three separate cases over the Trump administration's decision to wind down DACA. What exactly is the court considering here? There's basically two issues, as I understand it.
That's correct. There are two questions presented to the Supreme Court of the United States with regard to the DACA case. The first question is whether or not the decision to rescind, the Trump administration's decision to rescind the DACA program, is reviewable. And the Trump administration is taking the position, not surprisingly, that it should not even be reviewed by the Supreme Court, that they can do basically whatever they want with respect to rescinding the program. And the second question presented is whether or not, if it is reviewable, it is legal.
There is something that comes into play in thinking about this case, which is called the Administrative Procedure Act. And without getting into the weeds too deeply, this has to do with what some people have described as the fourth branch of government, right? The agencies and that sort of thing, right?
That's correct. So one of the issues that's going to be discussed in the challengers to the DACA rescission. So the plaintiffs are arguing that the Trump administration violated the APA, which is the Administrative Procedure Act. And basically what it is the APA requires that there be a certain procedure. For example, notice and comment. There has to be a reasonable decision. It has to be based on the facts or the law. And it also cannot be arbitrary and capricious.
So they're going to say that this was all of the above, it sounds like. Arbitrary and capricious. It wasn't based on anything, based in fact, or that sort of thing. How do we get to this point? This you have to go back to the Obama administration and concerns about the DACA program's imposition in the first place, correct?
That's correct. So DACA was rolled out on June 15th, 2012 by the Obama administration, as you said. And there's been a long history. This is an important point. It's been a long history of prosecutorial discretion. And so what that means is that the administrations in the past, not just Obama, but also, going back to Carter and Reagan and the Bush administrations, have used prosecutorial discretion to apply the law in a humanitarian way. So this is not something that's illegal. It's not something that's unconstitutional. It's something that's part of our law, and Obama had the right to do it. But of course, the Trump administration is taking another perspective on that.
You know, the political stakes are enormous here, and a decision isn't likely to come until next summer, which would just put us at months before the election. What do you make of that timing?
Yeah, I think that's a key point. You know, obviously, this will have some impact on the political process. I think it is part and parcel of the attempt by the Trump administration to show or at least provide his supporters with the ability to, in his words, fight against illegal immigration. However, at the same time, it should be mentioned that the Trump administration and Trump himself said he would protect Dreamers. He would protect DACA recipients. So there's been a little bit of a mixed message on this. And also, you have to understand that there are 700,000 people who will be substantially prejudiced if the DACA program is rescinded.
Do you see this? Well, let me ask you. I don't want you to predict the outcome here, but how do you see this playing out among the justices?
The United States Supreme Court is very difficult to predict how it's going to come out. But I think if you ask me my prediction, I think that the Supreme Court will find that it's a violation of the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act. I think that they will remand it, which means they'll send it back for further litigation. And this process could take a matter of months, if not years.
So that would mean that even though the matters of law might be decided, the actual outcome of this case could go on past the election season, perhaps.
I think the case will proceed past the election, and I think that we will not see the end of it for many, many months, if not years.
Jeffrey Hoffman is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Houston. Professor, thanks so much for your insight. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, by now you've probably heard our reports on how thousands of asylum seekers are stuck in Mexican border towns up and down the U.S.-Mexico border. In Matamoros, on the other side of the border across from Brownsville, more than 1,500 asylum seekers are said to be living in squalid conditions in a tent encampment. Mexican officials want them to move. And so Mexican authorities appear to be taking a page from the Trump administration's playbook, threatening to separate asylum seekers from their children. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. reports now from Matamoros.
A Mexican child welfare official holding a clipboard addressed a crowd of asylum seekers last week. They're in a sprawling tent encampment near the international bridge that connects Matamoros to Brownsville, Texas.
Si esto es voluntario, don, si ustedes no quieren, a mí me faculta fácil, con seguridad pública, agarro el niño y me lo llevo, y lo voy a regresar a su país.
In this video taken by a migrant, the official tells them the encampment is no place for children, and that he has the authority to take custody of their kids if they don't move. The parents object.
How would you like it if we took a child by force from your home?
The child welfare agency in Matamoros did not respond to repeated requests for an interview with NPR. In written statements to the media, the agency says not a single child was taken. The agency says the social workers who went to the encampment just wanted to offer the families space at a new shelter. Erin Thorne Vela is with the Texas Civil Rights Project. She hopes Mexican officials do keep families together.
I was really surprised that this tactic would be taken of like essentially a new type of family separation on the Mexican side.
She points out that the Trump administration got a lot of blowback over its family separation policy, aimed at discouraging migrant families from illegally crossing into the U.S.
I would think that they would see how this is really not a good idea, and it's not gonna end in a good result to threaten people.
Many migrants have been forced to wait in Mexico, sometimes for months, for their hearings in U.S. immigration court under the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. Migrants say they prefer to live in the encampment where they feel protected by American aid groups and have access to legal help. And they have been largely ignored by the U.S. and Mexican governments. That is, until last Friday, when Mexican officials decided they wanted to clear the encampment and move the migrants. Some of them are living in tents. Others sleep under bushes or on the streets. Many bathe in the Rio Grande. Matamoros' mayor, Mario Lopez, says he's concerned about public health and the migrants' well-being.
Bueno, pues transmitir confianza que los estamos atendiendo bien.
I want to convey confidence that we're treating them well and that we have our doors open to migrants and help them so they can get to their destination, which is the United States.
Lopez says the government would not forcibly move asylum seekers to the shelter. Still, panic has been spreading. Migrants say some of the child welfare officials went tent to tent looking for children. One Honduran mother said she refused to let them take her son.
I told them I couldn't, that I wouldn't let my kid go. And they told me I didn't know the laws here in Mexico.
She says an official handed her a notice to appear at a child welfare office, but she had no intentions of going. She asked that we not use her name because she fears retribution. Like most migrants camped out at the bridge, she says she has no plans on going to the shelter, a converted gymnasium that can house 300. I was able to go inside the shelter, which is only about a third full. I spoke to another Honduran mother who says she was happy to come here with her son. She says they get three meals a day. There are restrooms and they sleep in a bed. Back at the encampment, advocates, including Amnesty International, say they are monitoring the situation to make sure the human rights of migrants are respected. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Matamoros.
Joining us once again, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. So, Wells, how was your weekend? Good one?
Oh, wonderful weekend, David. Wonderful.
Fabulous.
Hearing from lots of folks about today, Veterans Day. You know, It may be a three-day weekend for some folks out there.
Right.
Via Twitter, in San Antonio, Anthony Martinez notes that today is Veterans Day. And let's not forget to thank with compassion and sincerity the homeless veterans who are now alone, feeling sick or without hope. Please let them know that they are appreciated and help is available. In El Paso, Michael Tipton writes, from one veteran to another. It was an honor to serve alongside you, before you, and most importantly, to carry on your legacy. Thank you for setting the example and for your sacrifice. Integrity first. And in Dallas, Patrick Walker, he tweets, today is a day to celebrate our heroes and remind them that they didn't come home to be forgotten. High five a veteran today and every day, and hug one if they'll allow it. And while they don't know what to do with a thank you, give it to them anyway. Salute. From Patrick Walker there via Twitter. Yeah, lots of folks making note of Veterans Day there on Twitter and on social media generally. Just one story we're keeping an eye on here as the week starts. I'll be back with more from social media later in the show. And you know, I know we're going to have more about Veterans Day coming right up here on the program.
Awesome.
Well.
Hey, veterans, we salute you. Let us know your stories of a favorite veteran, or perhaps you have you're a veteran yourself. You have a story to share. Tweet us at Texas Standard, or join us on any social media platform. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, will be back in 35 with more.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
Hey, it's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, talking about Veterans Day today. Folks from all over the Lone Star State honoring veterans, with one of the largest concentrations of veterans and military families in the country, for that matter. The Alamo City also proudly calls itself Military City USA. And this weekend, as thousands attended the city's Veterans Day parade, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame found that for many there, the celebrations are as much about those who served as those who support them.
Just before noon, hundreds of people gathered near the federal courthouse, craning to see all the bright uniforms, instruments, and military vehicles.
It's just a glorious, beautiful day, and there's just so many people just waiting for the parade to start, which I think that's our signal.
That's Jolene Bennett. Her son is an Army soldier at Fort Benning. She's also the daughter of a World War II medic who served under General Patton. Since Bennett was a teenager, she says she's been steeped in her father's military history.
He was in six different campaigns. His last tour of duty was that they had to go through all the concentration camps and bury everyone and basically clean up all the experiments. So it was a lot.
She says she came out to the parade because it's important for military families to unite and support each other under one cause. The same is true for Veronica Bevins, an Air Force veteran who served in Desert Storm. She travels to San Antonio every year from Louisiana to celebrate Veterans Day and says veterans are now getting a better reception than in generations past.
What's really great, you know, I have my own children here today to experience it for themselves, show them just how important the veteran population is and how they need to be respected and honored for what they do, and the families too.
Bevan says she chose to deploy and needed a lot of support from loved ones back at home in order to get through it. She gestures at her daughter, Victoria Major, who's standing close by.
She was young, both her and my son, so I had to leave them behind. You know, as a mother and a veteran, we have two duties. And when you have to choose one duty over the other, it's difficult.
Now, all grown up, Bevins' daughter is months away from signing on the dotted line and enlisting in the Air Force.
I know she always tells me that she doesn't want me to follow in her footsteps, but this is the part where I'm like, you know what? This is my path. This is what I was meant to do. She's inspired me, helped me along the way. Couldn't ask for a better rock.
For many in this city, Veterans Day is very much a family affair. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Texans who love wine and cheese from Europe may want to stock up now. A lot of folks, from consumers to retailers and wholesalers here in the U.S., preparing for 25% tariffs to take hold on imports from Europe. What's at issue? A 15-year-old dispute over airplanes. That's all. And now, if all this sounds somewhat baffling, we'll fasten your seatbelts, tray tables to the upright and lock position. Tom Benning, a D.C.-based reporter for the Dallas Morning News, joins us to help us understand things. Tom, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
This is not formally over airplanes or airlines per se. We're talking about the construction and manufacturer of airplanes, right?
That's absolutely it. You have the situation where you have Boeing in the United States and then Airbus in Europe. They're both pointing their fingers at each other saying, you're getting unfair subsidies from the government, whether that's through tax breaks or some other kind of financial assistance. And they've been saying this for over a decade, and it's just taken this long for the governing body that rules on these things, the World Trade Organization, to issue the first part of the ruling, where they said, Airbus, you're in the wrong. That allows the United States to dole out a punishment, and the punishment is tariffs, $7.5 billion worth. And while some of that covers what you would expect in an airplane dispute, that would be airplanes, there wasn't enough airplane production to cover the whole amount. So the United States looked elsewhere. And where do you go to hurt Europe? You go to things like wine and scotch and cheese.
But now I want to understand something. If the World Trade Organization sided with the U.S. in this dispute, does that give the U.S. The green light to impose tariffs on other things, not airplanes?
It does. I mean, it gives them a pretty wide purview to pick and choose what they want to put the tariffs on. Basically, the World Trade Organization gave a dollar amount, $7.5 billion worth of goods that the U.S. can impose tariffs on. Kind of the strange part of this is that they still have yet to rule on the other part of the case, which is the complaints that Europe has about Boeing. So you could end up with the WTO taking the exact same sort of decision and saying, well, Europe, now you can impose tariffs on goods imported to Europe from the U.S. So you kind of end up with this stalemate of sorts. And in the meantime, businesses and consumers in the U.S. are kind of left holding the bill.
Speaking of bills, what are we talking about paying more for? Brie and scotch, I guess?
Yeah, or Parmesan or, you know, prosciutto or so a nice red wine from France. All of those items are going to be hit by the 25% tariff. Now, it will depend on how much of a price increase you'll see based on, in some cases, European brands have said, well, we're going to help you cover some of this added cost, at least through the holiday season, which is the key season for, you know, retailers. But in other cases, businesses, you know, they don't have the kind of profit margins to to deal with that. So if you're looking at, say, a $100 bottle of scotch, the math is real simple. That's an extra $25 that you'd be dealing with there.
So as I understand it, I guess the actual timetable here, the WTO made its ruling on October 18th. So am I to understand that already these prices are going up because of the tariffs, but retailers and wholesalers are absorbing some of those costs already?
Well, certainly. We talked to a cheese shop in Dallas, Scardello, where just last week they got their first shipment come in with the extra costs on some of the cheeses they sell there. In other cases, it could take a little while because if you're, say, a big if you're a liquor store and you have inventory that you don't plan to just run out right before the holiday season, so it may take a little while for their inventory at the pre-tariff price to run out.
Does any of this have to do with President Trump's current interest in engaging some other regions in trade wars?
Well, it certainly fits kind of the broader narrative of that President Trump has been very aggressively protectionist in his trade agenda. Everybody by this point is familiar with the trade war with China and the tariffs that have been levied in there, in that fight. But it is different in two key points. One, as we discussed earlier, this fight is dated back 15 years.
Yeah, right.
So, and secondly, you mentioned or you heard me mention the WTO multiple times. That indicates that this went through the normal kind of process outlined by global trading rules. Whereas with the trade war with China, President Trump has moved more unilaterally in that regard and upset some other trading partners by doing that. So the president certainly has cheered on this ruling. He's complained for a long time that the EU has taken advantage of the U.S. on trade, and not just as it relates to airplane manufacturing, but it is different in some key ways.
Tom Benning is a reporter with the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Tom, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Support for A Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. A preventative regimen including a healthy diet and exercise can help prevent lung cancer. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz joins a growing number of state lawmakers and celebrities calling for the execution of death row inmate Rodney Reed to be delayed. The Texas Republican says evidence in the case needs to be weighed carefully. Reed is scheduled to die November 20th for the 1996 murder of Stacy Stites, but his guilt is widely doubted. Ceremonies in Texas today honoring those who served in the U.S. military include placing nearly 20,000 flags at veteran cemeteries across the state. The General Land Office oversees the locations in Abilene, Corpus Christi, Killeen, and Mission. Agency spokesperson Karina Erickson says the public is welcome to help place a small American flag at each of the 18,902 veteran grave sites.
It is at all four state veteran cemeteries. Everyone is invited to come out, but go to the cemetery closest to you and hopefully can come out and help us honor our veterans.
Flag laying in Killeen began this morning. The ceremonies at the other three Texas State Veterans Cemeteries will be held this afternoon. Democratic presidential hopeful Julian Castro says it's time to reshuffle the order of primary states. The former San Antonio mayor told MSNBC Sunday the demographics of Iowa and New Hampshire are not reflective of the country or the Democratic Party.
Of course, we need to find other states. And that didn't mean that Iowa and New Hampshire can't still play an important role, but I don't believe that forever we should be married to Iowa and New Hampshire going first. And that's just the truth of the way that I see it.
Castro has not yet qualified for the Democratic Party's fifth presidential primary debate later this month. He must meet the requirements by Wednesday to make the debate stage. Governor Greg Abbott is making state resources available to 53 counties dealing with drought. He issued a disaster declaration Friday for areas in North, South, and Central Texas. Abbott's office says low rainfall and prolonged dry conditions increase the threat of wildfire and pose an imminent threat to safety and property. And the San Antonio Spurs are retiring Tony Parker's number 9 jersey tonight. The former NBA player spent 17 of his 18 seasons with the team. The 6-time All-Star won 4 NBA championships with the Spurs and was the 2007 Finals MVP. A variety of celebrities have been sharing messages on Twitter honoring Parker, including rapper Snoop Dogg.
TP9! Tony Parker, this your boy Big Snoop Dogg, man. Congratulations. You know I love you, man. Spurs point guard for life, man. Do your thing. Big Snoop Dogg, I love you, Tony.
The 37-year-old retired from the NBA this summer. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Nurse Practitioners, celebrating National NP Week, November 10th to the 16th. Texas is home to over 25,000 nurse practitioners, providing high-quality care to Texans every day. Information at texasnp.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. He was revered by many as one of their own. Bolivia's first indigenous president in a country long led by what many there consider to be an elite group of people of European descent. He was swept into power on a wave of leftist sentiment across Latin America, and he stayed there longer than any other current head of state in the region. But after relentless protests, a dramatic turn of events on Sunday, Evo Morales resigned the presidency of Bolivia. Mark Jones is the Joseph D. Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies at Rice University, and he joins us now. Professor Jones, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Oh, thanks for having me on today.
A little bit of the backstory here. He was head of the movement, still is head of the movement for socialism, as I understand it, took office in 2006. What did he promise to do? He was a critic of neoliberalism, right?
He was a strong critic of neoliberalism, and he had his rise essentially in response to the presidency of Gany Sanchez Lozada, who implemented the Washington Consensus neoliberal reforms of free markets and privatization in Bolivia that only reinforced the inequality in the country. And Morales was a standard bearer and a supporter for indigenous rights, particularly those of the Aymara and Quechua people, who represented the majority of the Bolivian population.
Did he actually, there's been a lot of concern about the gap between the wealthy and the poor in Bolivia. Did he do much to narrow that gap?
I think he did. He focused, unlike, say, populists like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela or Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua that effectively killed the goose that laid the golden egg and led to economic crisis, Morales did a good job balancing reductions in economic inequality mm-hmm. with economic growth and promoting the lithium sector, which is a source of development in Bolivia, as well as the gas industry, so that he was able to reduce inequality and improve the standard of living of a large number of Bolivians.
Having said that, in La Paz, Bolivia's main city over the weekend, there were chants, this is not Cuba, this is not Venezuela. They said, this is Bolivia and Bolivia will be respected, referring to Bolivian laws and its constitution. What happened? Why did he lose popular support, or at least appear to lose popular support?
Well, it all began back in 2014 when, under the constitution that he had drafted, he shouldn't have been able to run for a third term. He effectively interpreted the constitution as it wasn't his third term under that constitution. Then in 2016, when he was clearly under his own constitution, barred from seeking re-election, he held a referendum to allow that would have, if it had passed, would have allowed him to run for re-election. It failed, as a majority of the population said no. Then he went to his PAC Supreme Court, and they decided that the Constitution was unconstitutional because it prohibited Evo Morales from running for re-election. And so that's how set the stage for the 2019 election. Now, in this election, the opposition had grumbled, but they still were fighting the good fight against him, or mm-hmm. at least they were contesting it. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that during the middle of the counting, Morales looked like he was going to have to go to a runoff against Carlos Mesa, the main opposition candidate. The computers crashed, or essentially it stopped reporting results. And lo and behold, when they came back up, Morales had a 10% gap over Mesa, which allowed him to win without going to a runoff.
Okay, so this, of course, feeds into the stories, the concerns about fraud, which are rather widespread. There were protests. He appeared to be abandoned by his allies. Now, what I find rather interesting is that some governments, including Mexico, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, declaring this a military coup. He does appear to have lost the support of the police and armed forces, but was there an actual coup underway?
No, I really don't think you can call it a coup. Now, you could see it that way, but what really happened was Morales committed massive fraud to win the election. The Organization of American States did an audit of the election and concluded quite clearly that fraud was engaged in. Morales decided to call for new elections, but the opposition didn't trust Morales to run those elections. Mm-hmm. And so they kept the protests going. What the military effectively said was, we aren't going to step in and repress the Bolivian citizens who are protesting against you. And then if this can't be resolved, you should resign.
Professor,
so I view it as a coup.
Professor, just a few seconds left here, but who's running Bolivia? I mean, who becomes the lawful president now?
It's the second, the number two person in the Senate. It's Jeanne Añez, although she actually can't assume office until Congress votes her in. And since the MAS party, Morales' party, has a majority in Congress, we could be essentially without a leader for some time, although all that leader is going to do is call new elections. But I would say Bolivia is going to be very chaotic for the near future because Morales does retain a support of about two-fifths of the population, and we're likely to see counter-protests and protests in a Bolivia that's very chaotic at least the near medium term.
Mark Jones, Joseph D. Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies at Rice University. Professor Jones, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
What's up, world? This is Saul Paul, S-A-U-L-P-A-U-L, one word, no space, two capitals, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Rise, rise, and open your eyes. Now is the time for you to shine. Yeah,
yeah, but the name Saul Paul is not my birth name. It's more than a stage name. It's quite significant to me. It represents this transformation that I went through. In the Bible, the Apostle Paul, before his name was Paul, it was Saul. He had a life transformation. I could relate to that, and I really felt it. Like, wow, I went from Saul to Paul. Shout out to all of my Texans. The world knows us.
Check it out. This is my new dance right here. That's that Texas two-step. It's real easy to do. Go like this right here. I said,
I love being from Texas. I love being from Houston, H-Town, the North Side. But I love Austin. You know, I came here and went to college at UT and graduated. Moved away a couple times and purposely moved back to Austin because I enjoyed it a lot. I started off just freestyle rapping, just making up songs on the spot. Being from Houston, I honestly believe everybody does that. It's kind of like how you like renew your citizenship every year. Like, I know people's grandparents to freestyle. Like, that's not a big deal. I've told the story for 15 years at all the, like, yeah, TED Talks, in front of kids, conferences, schools, everywhere, concerts. I didn't want to write the book until there was a reason to, until the time was right and it would be significant and the impact would be profound. Right. And the time was right.
All right, folks, let's go.
Now put your hands in the sky, wave them side to side. We ain't going nowhere, we just wave them bye-bye. All of the haters, to all the haters, to all of the haters.
It's so crazy. I feel like I can take 2 hours and give a good snapshot of my story, or 45 minutes, or encapsulated in a 3-minute song, or in 30 seconds or less, or 5 words. So basically I went from a prison incarceration to college graduation. I went from 4 felonies to a 4.0. If I zoom out a little bit from there, it's how I grew up in foster care, raised by my grandmother because my mom died when I was 3, and because my dad abandoned me before I was ever born. There was foster care, there was extreme poverty, it was juvenile incarceration, adult incarceration, but yet I was able to overcome and transition from tragedy to triumph. I'm excited about my new book, Be the Change. It's my memoir. And as I sat in prison, I realized, like, I had these, all these epiphanies, like, oh, that's what Principal Johnson meant. That's what Miss Anderson meant. And now no shame to them, because they had the best heart and they gave their best effort, but they didn't connect with me. And I realized that I connect with kids. Like, I talk and they understand. And I just feel I have this inherent responsibility to give back. And it's like so that they can live their best life. I said, one, two, step, baby, one, two, step. Touchdown, dance, celebrate yourself. I am Saul Paul, a musician with The Message, and you are listening to the Texas Standard. All of the haters, to all the haters, to all of the haters, and I'll see you later. Put your hands in the sky, wave from side to side.
And we are coming up on 44 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The U.S. women's soccer team dominated Costa Rica yesterday, winning 6-0 in a friendly that closes out the team's 2019 as one of its best seasons ever. But that's actually not unusual. The team has been dominant on the field for years, winning 6 World Cups and closing the season with 20 or more wins a full dozen times now. Yet, members of the team are in an ongoing fight for equal pay. And Friday, a judge granted their lawsuit class action status. For more on what that means, we turn to Darren Roberts. He's the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, always good to see you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So what does this class action status mean for the lawsuit? That it can now include women, what, who have joined the team since the original suit was filed, or what?
Yeah, so any woman who had trained or played with the national team over a multi-year period.
Because those people may have been affected by the prospects for earning.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you as a lawyer, you understand that it's difficult to get a class certified. And so this move in California really opens the doors to add additional litigants. And also, you will have evidence and testimony and narratives coming from other individuals beyond, you know, the Megan Rapinos that we know. And so this could be a really big move sort of in the women's fight for equality.
I feel like I've been hearing about this for a long time. Why has it been taking so long?
Well, you know, the federal legal structure is not one that sort of moves quickly.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at the scope of what the U.S. women's national team is really taking on, this will take a while. And so I don't think that there will be sort of any quick conclusion to this. But this is one of the milestones. I think when we look back on sort of the development of how this sort of went down, then this is going to be a big move.
But the interesting thing here is that America's team is not alone here. As I understand it, the women's team from Australia has been fighting too, and apparently with some degree of success.
Yes. So this gender inequity issue is not just resigned to the U.S. The Australian women have had some success in sort of evening that playing field. And now we just kind of have to wait and see if sort of that same success will come to the States.
Yeah, same has happened in Norway and New Zealand, I read, but not most places. Why is this happening? And why do you think this is happening, first of all, in you know, soccer, it seems like, is a big deal right now. What's happening?
So if you look at just at a business and a sports landscape, we know that women are underpaid in comparison to their male counterparts. Mm-hmm. The reason why this story with the U.S. women's national team has risen to such prominence is because they're so good, right? I mean, they dominate it, and they dominate in every tournament that they're in. And so when you look at their production versus the men, there's such a national, international, really, sort of highlight to the fact that, wow, these women are grossly underpaid, and they outperform their male peers.
There's a discrepancy here.
There's a huge discrepancy, and the fact that they're really good, and that shouldn't have to be the case, right? It shouldn't be a matter of a performance. That shouldn't be the only metric, but I think this adds another dimension to the story.
While you're here, I got to ask you about something else. President Trump made an appearance at the Alabama-LSU game over the weekend. Alabama putting up a fight, but ultimately LSU taking it. News here, though, is about the crowd reaction, right?
Yes. So Alabama may not let him come back after the loss to LSU. But, you know, this has been interesting because there was a lot of lead up to this appearance. The student government sort of issued a statement that any student who booed, you know, there would be repercussions. There were a lot of loud cheers. You know, Trump carried this state 62% in the 2016 election, so this isn't surprising. I also think if you look at the reception that he received, the Nationals versus the Astros
World Series game, right.
I think his staff is going to make sure that if he appears at a sports contest, it's south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Sort of tricky business trying to leverage a sports crowd.
I don't think he'll be attending the Rose Bowl anytime soon.
Darren Roberts is the founding director at the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, good to see you again, sir. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the immediate aftermath of mass shootings at El Paso and Midland, Odessa just a few weeks ago, some of the first responders were people there on scene who didn't wait for ambulances. Some were loading the injured into their own vehicles, racing off to the hospital, or trying to perform triage right there on the spot. In the minutes that follow such incidents, emergency resources always pour in to help victims and survivors. But what does it mean to be getting good at responding to mass shootings? Guns in America's Lee Patterson reports on a grim but growing and increasingly sophisticated infrastructure.
I caught up with Sandy Phillips on her cell phone in a rental car.
We are traveling 95 from D.C. to Virginia Beach.
Sandy and her husband Lonnie usually have bags ready to go, but they were already on the road. This trip was a detour.
We need to stop and buy underwear and some clothing to get through the rest of the week. But this is just part of what we do.
What the Phillips do is travel around the country to the sites of mass shootings.
The first one that we went to was 5 months after my daughter was killed.
Sandy's daughter, Jessica, died in the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012. When I talked with them in June, they were headed down to Virginia Beach. A dozen people had just been killed in a shooting at a municipal building. This incident was number 11 for them. When they arrived, they first went to the site of the shooting to pay their respects and talk to police. Then they headed over to the rec center to try and meet with survivors, though people don't always want to talk.
The first thing we always tell them about is that, you know, we understand exactly what they're feeling because we've been in their shoes, and that right now you don't even feel like you want to live. You just want to curl up and die. And it's a normal part of the trauma that you have endured.
A few months later, I met up with Sandy and Lonnie on the outdoor patio of a restaurant in Aurora, not far from Denver. And I asked them, since they started doing this work, what's changed?
Unfortunately, I think we've become more sophisticated, which is good, but so very sad at the same time that we have allowed this to redefine our country in such a way that we're getting good at how we respond to mass shootings.
The Phillips themselves have become more sophisticated over the years. Now they give advice on how to deal with reporters, what to do about online harassment, and how to spot scammers trying to make money off of tragedy. Eric Pearson, president of the El Paso Community Foundation, is dealing with these kinds of financial issues after a gunman killed 22 people at a Walmart there in August.
Each person has an individual set of needs and an individual situation that we're trying to deal with. A good example is, you know, how bad is the injury? What does that mean to you in terms of caring for your children?
He's talked with national and community foundations that have managed funds after other mass shootings. He says it's disturbing that there's almost a playbook for doing this work, but
we're not walking through the forest blind. There's a path in front of us that if we can find our part of that path, we can do right by this community.
During our interview, Sandy Phillips described a predictable group of people who always seem to show up to mass shootings. The guy from Illinois who makes the white crosses. Religious groups like the Billy Graham Rapid Response Team, the lady from the Red Cross, and more recently, therapy dogs. They came to El Paso with Janice Marut from Lutheran Church Charities.
They're comfort dogs. These dogs live in Nebraska, Colorado, and Texas.
The Golden Retrievers were stationed at the city's memorial near the baseball stadium not long after the shooting.
Oh, we've been to Orlando, Santa Fe, Harvey, Sutherland Springs. I mean, tornadoes, floods, fires, just wherever we're asked to go. Unfortunately, too many shootings.
Lonnie and Sandy Phillips were in El Paso, too. And this time, they ran into a new organized group of people that they had never really seen before. Dozens of trauma therapists meeting with victims at the community center and hospitals.
So the people who had witnessed the shooting and were upset, they were able to get help immediately. And that's what we've been preaching for 7 years.
And it's the new project they're working on right now, building teams of survivors and trauma therapists to go into communities after incidents like mass shootings. They hope to pilot the program in Colorado, where their daughter was killed. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Guns in America and our partner station KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. That sound means our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is back in the house. Hello there. Happy Veterans Day to you.
Happy Veterans Day to you as well, David. You know, we mentioned that earlier, one of the trending topics on Twitter. Here's another provocative subject we're seeing out there trending. Boycott Uber is trending. Yes, after the ride-hailing company's CEO made controversial comments downplaying the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This backstory here, Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi, he was speaking on Axios on CBS, HBO, the news magazine there. Right. He called Khashoggi's death and dismemberment reportedly at the hands of Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, is a huge Uber investor, a serious mistake, and went on to compare the murder to mistakes Uber has made, like its implementation of its self-driving car program. And he basically summed it up as follows, quote, "So I think that people make mistakes. It doesn't mean that they can never be forgiven." The CEO is obviously has sort of backtracked from that and apologized for downplaying the incident here. But again, that hashtag boycott Uber trending and lots of people sounding off, as in Austin, where Sean Kent, he tweets that this is such a mind-bogglingly awful quote and a window into Silicon Valley's immoral culture. Also, Uber paid this guy $45 million last year, but the company lost billions and drivers can't feed their families. How does that work? Provocative subject there, to be sure. Well, here's another viral story that folks are talking about, a little slightly more lighthearted there. A recent ruling from the National Transportation Safety Board can now add plane crash to the list of gender reveal related accidents.
Excuse me, say that one more time.
Gender reveal related accidents. You know, these are those sort of made for viral moments where it's like you're going to announce the sex of your child, you know, boy or girl.
Okay.
And so people have been ratcheting this up to sort of extreme levels. And so, case in point, there was a plane crash in Turkey, Texas, that's at the base of the panhandle, back in September. Mm-hmm. But this determination from the safety board just came down. What happened is that the pilot of this small plane dumped out some 350 gallons of pink-colored water.
What?
But moments after, you know, obviously, the female gender there. But moments after doing so, the plane stalled. It crashed. The plane was destroyed. No serious injuries, thankfully.
Gosh.
But again, it joins this growing number of these like extreme sort of gender reveal stunts, you know, made for YouTube and stuff.
I sort of misunderstood something when you said the pink stuff. You know what I thought of? I thought of that flame retardant stuff.
This was designed to sort of say
it's a girl.
It's exactly
okay.
It's a wild incident, and I've said, and again, they have been some very serious ones. There's this one stunt in Arizona that actually led to a 45,000-acre forest fire when this guy was shooting packets that had colored dust inside of them, and one of them ignites. Crazy story. On our Facebook page, John Davis says, "Just like the vast majority of parties, no one will remember your gender reveal celebration after the child is born, unless you crash a plane." They probably will remember that. Again, thankfully, no one's seriously injured, but heck of a story. Yeah.
Taking a look at the thermometer right now, it's 73 degrees in the Texas capital city. At 8 a.m. tomorrow, it's going to be 37 degrees. Can you believe it? Yeah, get ready for
Texas weather, people.
Yeah, Texas weather. It's going to get cold out there. Hey, bundle up. Get ready for some of that wintry stuff. We'll keep an eye on things for you. Keep it right here. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge,
Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.